From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am very happy. A great burden has been lifted from my back and from the back of all Kenyans. So we are celebrating our second liberation.
The opposition party has won in Kenya. The new president, Mwai Kibaki, has already been sworn in. More than a dozen protesters are arrested at the Pentagon today, and we'll hear a speech by the Reverend James Lawson.
We of the peace movement who have been struggling for 60 years for peace must become a justice movement in the United States. We must do our best organizing, not primarily around slogans of peace, but slogans of Saddam did not close our health clinics. Slogans of, like the one from the 1960s in the Vietnam War, ain't no Viet Cong ever called me a nigger.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Kenya, opposition leader Mwai Kibaki has won in a landslide vote, giving Kenya its first new government since it became independent in 1963. Kibaki becomes the country's third president after Kenya's founder, Jomo Kenyatta, and Daniel Arap Moi, who could not run for re-election. Kibaki won by a 2-1 margin over Moi's hand-picked successor, Uhuru Kenyatta, the son of Kenya's founding president. Other winners in Friday's election in Kenya include a former political prisoner and human rights activist, Kwagi Wa Wamwere, who won a seat in parliament. I reached him just before the program. He spoke to us from Nairobi.
Really, this is an expression of a great desire by the Kenyan people for change. And in voting for the opposition the way they did, I don't think that the Kenyan people are especially voting for the party, but more so for change. So the landslide victory is also a very big, while it is a sweet victory, it's also a big challenge to the leaders of the opposition, because it means people have very high expectations and what they want must be delivered before the goodwill disappears.
Did you win, Kwagi Wa Wamwere, for parliament?
Yes, I won very comfortably. I had a majority of about 17,000 votes. So, yeah, I did win.
So how does that feel for you that now Daniel Arap Moi and his party will be out of power, and you, who was a political prisoner under Daniel Arap Moi, have become a member of the Kenyan parliament?
For me, this is the second biggest day, the third biggest day in my life after the day of our independence, the day that I got married to my wife. This is the third biggest day. I am very happy. A great burden has been lifted from my back and from the back of all Kenyans. So we are celebrating our second liberation. And apart from that, this is a wonderful opportunity for me to resume my work where I left it. I come from a very poor constituency where people have no water, they have no jobs, they have no electricity, they have no roads. And I'm very much looking forward to taking up my work and trying to get these services to our people. And to me, I'm very much looking forward to resuming that duty.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Nairobi. We just came from a handing over ceremony. Moi has just handed over power to our new president, Mwai Kibaki. So here it is all celebration. I think we had more than 500,000 people in attendance. So here it is really carnival mood, and it's great. You can hear the shout.
Can you describe the scene?
Well, here, as I said, it is carnival mood. Everybody is hooting and laughing, and You know, we are all, it's like we are heading for heaven. I just hope that this will not be a disappointment. But people are extremely happy, extremely happy. But it was also a bad day for Moi, with all those people bidding him farewell and booing him and not, you know, it was bad for him. But very good for the Kenyan nation and the Kenyan people.
Koigi wa Wamweri, speaking to us from Kenya. He has just won a seat in the parliament, formerly imprisoned by the last president, Daniel Arap Moi. The latest news, the opposition leader Mwai Kibaki has just been sworn in as the new president of Kenya. In Yemen, three doctors from the United States have been shot dead after being attacked at a missionary-run hospital. A fourth doctor was wounded. Soon after the shootings, police arrested a man from Yemen who told police he'd shot the two men and to, quote, cleanse his religion and get closer to Allah. This according to a report by Reuters. The shooting come just after a month after the CIA bombed a car in Kenya, killing six men, one of them an American. The CIA said they were suspected of having al-Qaeda ties in Yemen. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said Sunday the U.S. does not plan to strike North Korea despite escalating tensions. Powell added the White House is, quote, looking for ways to communicate with North Korea. But the New York Times reported that the Bush administration plans to wage an economic war by possibly imposing sanctions and cutting North Korea's trade ties to neighboring countries. North Korea has disabled U.N. monitoring equipment and removed seals from nuclear facilities frozen under the agreed framework it signed with the United States in 1994. The energy-poor country said on December 12th it's restarting a 5-megawatt facility because it needs electricity after the United States cut off fuel shipments last month. And in Colorado, at least six Middle Eastern college students have been jailed in the past 2 weeks by the Immigration and Naturalization Service for failing to take enough college classes as required by their student visas.
Cry blood, Africa, cry blood. Cry blood.
Cry blood, Africa, burning spear, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Just before this broadcast, about a dozen people were arrested outside the Pentagon. Three of them threw blood on the Pentagon. The activists are from the Atlantic Life Community, a gathering of faith-based activists who traveled from around the country to Washington, D.C. This weekend. Last night in D.C., I spoke to Liz McAllister. She is a longtime Plowshares activist, lives at the Jonah House Resistance Community in Baltimore. She was arrested today at the protest and also on Saturday in front of the White House. She described first that action.
And we brought to the White House the message that the massacre of the innocents continues and intensifies in the policies of George W. Bush. And we had a silent procession, single file, up and down the sidewalk in front of the White House. And then we ended in what they refer to as the picture postcard zone, in a tight semicircle, filling that area. And at a signal, people cried out that that people were being killed. And a number of us staged a die-in, and four people poured their blood in the circle around the dead on the ground there. And the police moved to clear the sidewalk and ultimately arrest us. They arrested 16 of us yesterday. Two were charged with using the symbol of blood on the sidewalk. They are still in custody.
Liz McAllister describing Saturday's protests in front of the White House. She then talked about the plans for today's protest in front of the Pentagon. This is Liz McAllister of the Jonah House Resistance Community.
At 7 o'clock, and several people will use the symbol of blood on that building, and so announce that the blood is there, that the decisions made there and the policies implemented there are the cause of blood being shed. And what we try to say is that the blood is there. We only make it more visible.
Liz McAllister, speaking to us in Washington, D.C., just before today's protest in front of the Pentagon. Liz McAllister lives at the Jonah House community. She lost her husband, Phil Berrigan, just a few weeks ago. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we look at today's front page story in the Washington Post, the top story is a piece that Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill broke over the summer. It details how Donald Rumsfeld met with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein in 1983 to pave the way for normalization of U.S.-Iraqi relations. The Post reports that declassified documents show that Rumsfeld traveled to Baghdad at a time when Iraq was using chemical weapons on an almost daily basis in defiance of international conventions. A review of thousands of declassified government documents and interviews with former policymakers shows that U.S. intelligence and logistical support played a crucial role in shoring up Iraqi defenses against the, quote, human wave attacks by suicidal Iranian troops. The administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush authorized the sale to Iraq of numerous items that had both military and civilian applications, including poisonous chemicals and deadly biological viruses such as anthrax and bubonic plague. We now turn to a speech given by civil rights leader Reverend James Lawson. Reverend Lawson is considered one of the leading architects of the civil rights movement, was a mentor to Dr. Martin Luther King. Lawson's activism began during the Korean War when he was jailed as a conscientious objector. In 57, he met Dr. King. They joined forces to realize the dream of starting a nonviolent mass movement. That same year, Lawson went to Nashville to teach the mechanics of nonviolence to budding civil rights activists and continued to work with Dr. King until his death. For 14 years, Reverend Lawson served as president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization founded by Dr. King to end racial segregation through nonviolent protest. Reverend Lawson is currently pastor emeritus at Holman United Methodist Church in Los Angeles. Lawson spoke at the United Nations Church Center on December 9th, the day before dozens of church leaders marched on the United Nations on International Human Rights Day, many of them getting arrested on that day. This is the Reverend James Lawson.
If this government is to be changed, if the state governments, the state legislators, if the mayors and the council people, and then the presidents and the congressmen and the senators, if the members of the Pentagon, if the members of the CIA, if the members of the cabinet and administrative people ought to come to recognize their own humanity enough so that they may recognize they're all wrong, it will be because we, the people, mobilize not in the tens of thousands, but in the millions, and make life in this governed country for George Bush and for the ex-president, ex-governor of Pennsylvania Ridge, but the new Secretary of the Homeland Insecurity, unmanageable. Unmanageable. Nothing less than that will make a difference. Nothing less than that will make a difference. And so if we value our lives, and if we value this historic experiment of a people seeking to govern themselves in spite of all the underbelly difficulties and horrors, if we value a future for ourselves and for our children and grandchildren and the like, we must come to the notion that may be extremely costly, that only if millions of us are willing to risk our comfort and our strength, our positions and everything else, in order to put into the streets millions of people who say no, but who say thereby with that no, a yes to the possibilities of what democratic values and justice and equality and liberty can look like in our land. That's the first point I would like to make. The second point I want to make is that this cannot be done unless millions of us develop an an implacable hatred of violence and war in all their various seductive masks, whatever they be, whether it's capital punishment or punishing our children in unloving ways, whether it's the violence of structured poverty, whether it's domestic violence, whatever the form of violence is, whether it's the violence in our hearts and in our hands and in our voices, whatever it be, there can be no change in this country as long as millions of us in various ways cling to the superficial notion that there is something like redemptive violence, a little bit of violence that will change a regime and be a good. There is no such thing and can never be such a thing in the 21st century. War and violence are always tragic. I don't care whose it is. Always sinful. War is not a virtue. War is a sin. War and violence come out of the forces of spiritual wickedness in this country. They cannot be turned into good. As Jesus said it, a good tree produces good fruit, an evil tree produces evil fruit. You cannot grow bananas out of the genes of elephants, no matter what's going on in our land. Cannot be done. There is something in the very nature of the universe which has produced life, which insists that if we human beings want to experience the vast, infinite possibilities of life, eternal life now, then we must develop a repentance in which we shed our little likes and huge likes of violence and war in various ways. The scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures are very clear about this. All across the Hebrew scriptures, we get words like this from Psalm 33, a king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a vain hope for victory, and by its great might it cannot save. Not by might, nor by force, but by my power, saith the Lord. In spite of the fact that we Americans have taken great value from all the from the gods of war in the Hebrew scriptures and a little in the New Testament as well, it has to be said that that's a primitive conception of God. And we of the religious world have to shed our primitive notions of the God who many of us insist is reflected in the power of an Isaiah and in the power and the spirit of a Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus put it this way, Peter, put up your sword, for they who take the sword will perish by the sword. I want to say a word about us Christians, because we Christians have been the most warlike people of the last 500 years in the world. There is deep need for those of us who are baptized people of Jesus to repent of the violence of the past and of the present that we keep baptizing and calling redemptive and holy when it tramples upon the possibilities of life for literally millions of people yesterday and today. The last 500 years of the push from Europe around the world with the sword in one hand for conquest, and as Desmond Tutu has said, with the Bible in the other hand, and then gold in our lust has produced the kind of world in which we live today. And globalization, sisters and brothers, a big word, but it is nothing but certain folk in our land, largely white male, largely white supremacist males, who have decided to take over the cloak of the last 500 years of colonialism and imperialism and document it and forge it into the 21st century for another 100 years. That's what's going on. Globalization is nothing but the effort to spread plantation capitalism all around the world. That's what we've been doing.
The Reverend James Lawson, and we'll come back to him in just a minute here on Democracy Now! You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the Bush administration heats up its plans for war in Iraq, the peace movement around the world is gaining momentum. At least 23 U.S. cities have passed anti-war resolutions. Groups ranging from the National Council of Churches to chapters of the Sierra Club and the National Organization for Women have issued anti-war statements. In Britain, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, attacked the British government for its readiness to go to war, along with the United States, against Iraq. And the Pope has used his Christmas message to warn against war, as we go back to the speech of the Reverend James Lawson.
We Christians need to purge ourselves of this ethical nonsense about just war. Theologians and preachers and church bishops running around over the last year or two talking about just war. Well, they're by the criteria from Augustine to the present moment, the wars of the last 100 years have been wars in which women and children have been the primary victims. World War I was an exception where it was a ratio maybe of 10 to 1, but it was the last one. Our Spanish-American War in the Philippines killed at least 100,000 civilians. We don't know in our history books because no effort was made on the part of our government then in 1898-99 to document who was being killed in the Philippines. We saw it rather as our first step of becoming an empire, and the Philippines would be our first colony. All the other wars across the last 60 years, it's women and children who have been the combatants. There is something deep within my soul as a human being and as a man that thinks it's despicable and obscene for the Bushes and the Rumsfelds and others to make decisions for war in which it's the women and children of the world who are the victims. That is not humanity. It is not manliness. It is shameful. And how soon will some of us begin to say this and write this so that we can begin to turn the attitude in this land that makes war a play game so long as there are not American casualties. Well, the casualties in Iraq for the last 10 years, and I was there in the year 2000 myself, are beyond imagination.
their casualties, and I cannot figure out any sort of God who is more concerned about my granddaughter than the children of Iraq, the ones I saw in the hospitals in Basra and in Baghdad. If that is the kind of God we have, then I want nothing to do with that God. Nothing to do with that God. But there can be no such thing as a nonviolent passion without an implacable awareness of the way in which violence has done the human race and this land grotesque injustice. And this violence cannot be corrected with more violence. The 20th century has been the most violent century that we have known, both qualitatively and quantitatively. We have perfected violence as no other generation of the human race has done. But we need to be very aware, of course, that because we have perfected violence, we may have given ourselves and the human race, especially in the Western world, the power to commit suicide and to destroy the human race, not necessarily through nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction, but with a whimper, as W.H. Auden has said. We just keep tearing up the forests and polluting the water and filling the air with smog and continuing to go on with our technologies and our greed so that the warming of the earth continues to increase. We could destroy the human race with a whimper, without any big bang. So it's just as critical for us to recognize how in the economic order may be the worst form of violence that the world is experiencing today. Globalization and the like. Let me say something about this now that I hate to say, but which I think I must say. And that's this, that for the last generation, 30 years, I've been convinced that the number one enemy of justice and peace in the world is the United States. Now, that's a sobering thought, friends. Let's recognize that the mythology of our land is that we are the most beneficent, altruistic nation that has ever lived, and that our behavior domestically and internationally has ever been benign for liberty, for freedom, and so forth and so on. But I was doing workshops in the South in 58, 60, 61, helping to undergird the movement, when I read something that I can never forget, and it has torn me in the deep places where I've lived ever since. And it goes like this. In the 50s and early 60s, I had the privilege of being quite active in the World Student Christian Federation and the Methodist Student Movement. I did work camps in the United States and in India. And along the way, I met all sorts of folk from other lands, including Angola and Mozambique. I met Methodist colleagues from those two countries. And in the early 60s, the United States, our CIA, our Pentagon, our military intelligence, our White House, our State Department, were all on the side of the principle developed in the last 500 years that the Portuguese colonies in Africa, Angola, Mozambique, two of them, were provinces of Portugal. And the people there had therefore no right for self-determination. And so when the self-determination movements began in those two countries, I had fellow Methodists who were involved in those struggles. Eduardo Mondlane of Mozambique, and the name slips me now, in Angola. But our United States aid for the countries of Europe included shipping helicopters to Portugal for use in Angola, where they dropped napalm on Angolan villages, including Methodist churches. And I started pointing that out in the early 60s in the workshops on nonviolence. Now, the the point I'm wanting to make to you is that that's 30 years ago. One can go back more decades than that. But my thesis tonight is that the enemy is not Saddam or the Palestinians or the Israelis. The enemy is not the drug people in Colombia or whatnot. That the enemy is we, the American people, as we have allowed the powers of lust and greed in the United States to control our government in such a fashion that this government lies and steals and kills, exploits, runs over people, bullies people all over the world, picking up Middle Eastern looking people here in the United States the last year, holding them without any kind of charge, not charging them, not allowing their families to visit them, not allowing them lawyers, the whole business. That's not the work of a society or a government that is democratic. That's the work of a society that has become exceedingly, perhaps more than we know, tyrannical, authoritarian. We say we have the right to prevent preemptive strike. Well, that's what Japan did to us in 1941. Does this now mean that we will repent of World War II and that therefore Japan had the right to do that to us? That's what Hitler did in 1941 to the Soviet Union. The United Nations and the whole impact of a bipartisan political policies doing and after, immediately after World War II, was to create international law where what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq are crimes against humanity. Those are but small illustrations of it. The number one enemy of peace and justice, domestically and internationally, is this hierarchical government of the CIA, of the defense industries, of the transnational corporations, with the complicity of the White House and the military intelligence and the Pentagon and the Congresses, yielded to by the governors of this nation. When will we, the people of America, wake up and say no more? When will we withdraw our support? And then the last thing I want to say about that is this, that across these 400 years of history, as we have done despicable things to our own people and to other people, there has developed what Norman Mailer has called a hollow soul, and I think that's a good term in America, what Wendell Berry has called the hidden wound that's in all of us that needs to be healed. We have developed a mythological idolatry where are consumed with shame and guilt and denial that we have issues among ourselves that need to be faced and probed and examined in order for us to get some healing. I am absolutely persuaded that this country can be healed. We, the people, can be healed. That George Bush can be healed. But sisters and brothers, there can be no healing where the issues are not put on the table, as long as denial and shame and guilt interfere with our ability to reach up to the eternal and to seek mercy and grace and enough infusion of energy to be able to think about what repentance as a national spiritual movement would mean among us. Now let me for a moment just simply speak about why nonviolence is so important and why you have to have passion for it. When I say that, of course, many people think that nonviolence means wimpishness and acquiescence and passivity. There's a little book put out by a person, a scholar that I like, Ward Churchill, who is a Native American scholar at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. A division of HarperCollins has republished an essay of his called The Pathology of Pacifism, which I happened to get a hold of a few days ago and have started to read. He identifies pacifism as the fact that the Jews, by and large, in Europe did not organize early enough or heavy enough or tediously enough to become an effective resistance to Hitler's final solution. One can also say, nor did the Egyptians, nor did the Slavs, nor did the Slavs. But that is not pacifism. That is not nonviolence. Christopher Hitchens of Nation magazine has called all who are criticizing the Afghan war and the war on terrorism and Iraq, calling all of us who in any way criticize pacifist, who appease and cannot deal with life as it is. But in my judgment, none of that, of course. They're hitting at straw people. If they were honest men at this point of violence, nonviolence, they would take a long look at Gandhi or King. They would take a long look at the labor movement of the 20s and the 30s, where some of our grandparents and fathers and mothers demonstrated with strikes and sit-ins and lockdowns and boycotts by the thousands every year. That's what they would look at. They would look at the movement of symbolized by Martin Luther King Jr. Obviously, we were not engaged in some kind of wimpish running away from the problem because we chose nonviolence, but because we broke with the 20th century with its violence. Because there's another facet of the 20th century that is unknown, largely unknown. That is that in the 20th century, nonviolence as the politics of direct action by which conflict and struggle can create little measures and large measures of freedom and justice, equality, also became a mature literature that demonstrates the efficacy of nonviolence. We're unaware of this. We think that Gandhi invented it. Gandhi did not invent nonviolence. Gandhi, however, out of the depth of his own soul, as he wanted to struggle in South Africa against unrighteousness and civic horror, found out of his own life a form of resistance that he called at one point soul force. He rejected also the term non-resistance. He rejected also the term of pacifism.
in favor of the term soul force. Meaning what? Meaning that the gift of life for us human beings did not come powerless. That in our very pores, in our genes, God has sculptured us with the possibilities of power, the ability, the capacity to make change, the capacity to accomplish purpose. In that sense, nonviolence is nothing less than reaching into the spiritual core of our lives and affirming life and insisting that I'll solve problems of life not by becoming self-destructive, not by becoming destructive of life, but by affirming life and creating life. Nonviolence in the 20th century came of age. I refer you to the book by Gene Sharp, The Power of Nonviolent, The Power of Nonviolent Action, which is the classic now, written around 1972, but Gene spent some 30 years researching it. From all the written history that he could find available in Europe and the United States, he has codified the methods of nonviolence, the principles of nonviolence, the dynamics of nonviolent politics. And he gives illustrations from around the world. Most of the illustrations long before Gandhi.
You're listening to the Reverend James Lawson, and we're going to come back to the speech. But if you'd like to get a copy of it, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back to James Lawson in 60 seconds.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, o'er amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesty. Fruited plain, America, America.
Odetta singing America the Beautiful here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Despite a concerted effort by the Bush administration, more than two-thirds of Americans believe the president has failed to make the case that a war with Iraq is justified. This according to a Los Angeles Times poll. The overwhelming majority of respondents, 90%, said they do not doubt that Iraq is developing weapons of mass destruction. But in the absence of new evidence from UN weapons inspectors, 72%, including 60% of Republicans, said the president has not provided enough evidence to justify starting a war with Iraq. As we return now to the speech given in New York just a few weeks ago by the Reverend James Lawson.
Think for a moment in our own history. The American Revolution began with massive agitation, letter writing, conversations, small gatherings and large gatherings, began with refusal to pay taxes to King George, Boston Tea Party. It began with people resisting, not allowing British troops to live in their homes. It began out of a massive amount of agitation, in large measure, over a long period of time, in large measure, essentially using the weapons of nonviolence, though they did not call it that, but political action, yes. Or again, in the 17th century, William Penn received the charter for Pennsylvania. He was a Quaker, and he filled that Pennsylvania colony up with Quakers. They at that time were very strong in the notion that every human being had a spark of what they called a spark of God in them,
And so, therefore, every human being must be treated respecting that spark of God. And they determined in Pennsylvania that they would treat the people they found there in the same way they treated themselves. Do you know that in the colony of Pennsylvania for some 80 years, while the Quakers were in charge of that colony, not a settler was killed by a Native American, and not a Native American was killed by a settler. For 80 years, they had peace. Wars raged in New York and in New Jersey and Delaware and Maryland, but not in the colony. The Indian Wars in Pennsylvania began only after the Quakers lost the political leadership of that colony. Then wars began in western Pennsylvania and the like. That's from our own history. They did not call it nonviolence. So what? But they demonstrated it. We have hundreds and hundreds of illustrations of this kind in our own country. And what I want simply to try to suggest to you this evening is that we must tap those resources that are available. We must use the force more powerful, as Gandhi called it, that is more efficacious, more on the side of history, more on the side of justice and truth. We must not lose our souls to the evils we deplore. And so, I want to finally suggest we must emulate the civil rights movement of 1950s and 1960s. We can learn from it. We were by no means perfect. Lots of things, as I look back and have examined it and know full well what we could have corrected. The movement was not given a chance to mature, understand that. The assassinations of the 60s devastated this country, and we're still suffering from those assassinations. Changed this nation forever, and you hardly hear it even being recognized. We would not have a President George Bush today were it not for the assassinations of the 1950s and 60s. And I dare to say that. The movement had great power at various points, and it brought together millions of people in this country who said to the President and the Congress that it's time for segregation and discrimination to end. It hasn't ended, but at least there were those millions of voices who insisted that it was time for it to end. Let me give you just one illustration of the power of that movement that you and I take for granted now. Today, all of us can travel pretty much at will with who we wish to travel almost anywhere in the country. But let me point out to you that in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s, this was not the case. From Atlanta to Oregon, from Arizona to Cincinnati and places in Pennsylvania, there was a kind of an apartheid in this land by custom, by the quietness of the people of the land, by law, by signs. My first demonstrations against that took place in Ohio and Indiana and Michigan and Illinois, not in Alabama, where the custom of refusing service to people of color was considered in many places normative. Well, what changed it? Not the Kennedy administration, though they grew and though they were helpful. What changed it was simply this. On February the 1st, 1960, the first sit-ins in the South began in Greensboro, North Carolina. We had organized for some weeks in Nashville, Tennessee, and our first sit-in of some 75 people began February the 13th. That movement spread pretty quickly to 40, 50 states in our country, to all 50 states, rather, where all sorts of student groups, but community groups, and yes, people of religion joined in supporting it in various ways. Nashville was called the Model Movement by Martin King. And it's there that we had trained with great urgency and discipline, like becoming an athlete, a warrior. And so then the arrest took place on the 27th of February. We had several hundred people ready to be arrested. The police didn't know quite what to do with us on that day. They arrested only about 70 or 80 people, and then they stopped and told the counters and restaurants to close down for the day. But we had, at the end of the day, several hundred people sitting in the First Baptist Church at Capitol Hill in Nashville, waiting for my assignments to them to go places to be arrested, and when and where. Well, on May 10th, the first signs in the South came down, white-colored waiting rooms and restrooms, 1960, and a peaceful revolution began all across the nation. Some 300 communities in the Southeast and Southwest pulled the signs down in 1960 alone. Some 300 communities. The mopping up exercise and the follow-up exercise took all of the decade of 1960s. There may be some places still in our country that will be inhospitable to the young or to the gay or to the people of color and so forth and so on, according to local so forth. But you and I can now travel all across our country and we can be served in a great variety of places because of a peaceful, nonviolent revolution. Now, it does not mean there was not violence or sacrifice. There was. The forces of Trent Lott and Pat Robinson were there, and those forces were extremely hostile and at various times extremely violent. I was expelled from Vanderbilt University and arrested in the Nashville scene as well. The point I'm making is that there are sacrifices that could be made, but it demonstrates the power in our own last couple of decades, three decades, the power of nonviolent action. So what I propose is this, that we of the peace movement who have been struggling for 60 years for peace must become a justice movement in the United States. That we must do our best organizing. We must do our best organizing, not primarily around slogans of peace, but slogans that Cherry represents. Slogans of Saddam did not close our health clinics. Slogans of, like the one from the 1960s in the Vietnam War, ain't no Viet Cong ever called me a nigger. How do we get people of color and students and religionists in the scenes where people hurting to see that peace and justice go hand in hand? No peace, no justice. No justice, always instability. The book of Proverbs says that the king establishes, the president, the government establishes stability through justice. Moses insists that justice and only justice you shall pursue. Peace is the way, the only way. Justice is the cause of peace. What we need today, adding on to what Phyllis has already said, is not a single civil disobedience act, not a single picket line, but we need to plan for tomorrow, and for a week from tomorrow, and a month from tomorrow, and 6 months from tomorrow, we must plan a protracted struggle. And it must be a struggle deeply rooted in the infinite possibilities of nonviolent political, social, moral action. And it's my contention that if we're willing to make that sacrifice, to do that kind of suffering, to engage in that kind of struggle, we can take this beautiful land and this beautiful people back away from the covert government of George Bush or Bill Clinton and put it back into the hands of the people. I say our slogan for peace must be equality, liberty, and justice for all, 50 states, every person, everywhere. I say we must demand that there be a conversion from the military budget to the budgets of education and health care and affordable housing and jobs and transportation, and that they recover their humanity enough to become men and women who want our land, this experiment in democracy, to prevail and to continue. Only then, in the words of Langston Hughes, can we make America be America for me and for you and for the people that Sherry has talked about, for the folk who are homeless in New York and in Los Angeles, and for every boy and girl everywhere. That's will become passionate nonviolence.
The Reverend James Lawson speaking in New York, across the street from the United Nations, right around the time of International Human Rights Day, when close to 100 people, mainly religious leaders, were arrested for the U.S. plans and the U.N. resolution calling for or allowing the bombing of Iraq. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a video or audio cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. And as we come to the end of 2002, we encourage you to call in to our listener comment line and let us know what you think are the most important stories of 2002. And we're going to be playing some of your comments on tomorrow's program. Our phone number to call in your comments is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. And again, if you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call toll-free 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro. Special thanks to Uri Galed, Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Johnny Sender, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi, and all the volunteers who helped put together Democracy Now! Again, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And for the new year, we hope you will call friends who don't get to hear Democracy Now! And encourage them to call their community radio stations to broadcast Democracy Now!, any public radio station the country can broadcast us. You can also call your public access TV station. We are a television show as well, and they too can run Democracy Now! Go to our website, get the information at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!